91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. We spend this hour with Johns Hopkins University neuroscience professor David Linden. He's written Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Touch has a vital role in almost every human endeavor. Touch nerves and circuits are varied, from those which can distinguish a quarter among a pocket full of change to those which beg to be scratched. Experts say those who lose their sense of touch are more greatly debilitated than those without sight or hearing. Touch has a relationship with psychiatric and physical medical conditions as well. Stay tuned. Professor David Linden and Touch in a Topical Currents rebroadcast. First, NPR and regional news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Beautiful day here in South Florida.
Don't rub it in.
I won't too much. Well, stay with us now for a fascinating hour while we chat about the splendid human sense of touch. The most sophisticated robot could easily be put to shame by the complexity, sensitivity, and discernment displayed by humans.
And it isn't any stretch to consider it our most important sense. We're now joined by Johns Hopkins School of Medicine neuroscience professor Dr. David Linden. His latest book is Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And alas, he joins us from public station WYPR in Baltimore, where he had to trudge through the snow to be with us today. Welcome, David.
For having me, you warm people.
Yes, we won't tell you how warm it is. Okay, so let's begin with the basics. We tend to focus so much on our other senses without much thought to touch, and we take it so largely for granted, yet you argue it's essential to our survival and our early development. In what ways?
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. I think the reason that we take it for granted is because we can't ever experience the loss of it. We can all close our eyes and imagine being blind and plug our ears and imagine being deaf, but there's nothing you can do to turn off your touch sense because it's always on. And what we know is that touch in early human development is not optional. You can be born blind, and your mind and your body will develop normally, and you can have a great life, and the same with being born deaf. But if you're born with a sense of touch, but you don't receive loving interpersonal touch when you're a toddler and when you're a newborn, then a whole host of disasters unfolds. Compulsive, self-soothing rocking motions, attachment disorders, cognitive delays, and even problems with development of the body with the immune system and the gastrointestinal system. And if there is no intervention in the first 2 years, these problems actually last throughout life.
I suppose that's why so many criminals have either been ignored or abused as children and wind up head cases.
Well, has it been linked with criminal behavior?
Well, it has in the case of children in the orphanages in Romania in the 1980s and 90s who were really drastically ignored and really had almost no social touch whatsoever. But keep in mind, these kids also had a lot of problems. They were the poorest of the poor to start with.
What about people who don't like to be touched? Would that necessarily be as a result of touch deprivation? Or are there those who are genetically programmed that way and when they suffer the same consequences?
I would say the answer is probably neither of the above.
Okay.
It's very likely that there are genetic variants that alter people's touchy-feeliness, if you will, people who like or dislike to be touched. And I think many people are aware that folks who are on the autism spectrum often have a sensitivity to interpersonal touch, although we don't really understand why that is. It's a well-established correlation. There is really not I think for most people who don't like being touched, it did develop as a result of experience, but it's not clear that it is related to touch deprivation in early life.
The brain isn't passive in regard to touch, but how does it influence what we feel?
Well, if we look in the skin, if I can start with the skin before the brain,
okay.
If we look in the skin, we see many different nerve endings, and they're specialized. There's one for heat, one for cold, one for itch, ones for different aspects of mechanical sensation like texture and vibration and skin scratching. But these different parallel pathways of information come to the brain, and they sort into two different brain locations. One part of the brain, called the somatosensory cortex, is there just to tell the facts of touch, what we call the discriminative aspects. Where on my body am I being touched? What's the quality of that touch? How intense is it? And then there's a completely separate part of the brain called the posterior insula that is there to give the emotional tone to touch. So that's what makes a caress feel good, or an orgasm feel good, or pain feel bad.
Well, what about if, you know, I can be, someone touches you and it repels you, it repulses you. Another person touches you in exactly the same place and you feel either loving feelings or loving emotions or sexual feelings. How does that work? It's about the context?
Oh, all perception is about the context in touch or anything else. Let me give you an example from one of my favorite cartoons. So in this cartoon, there's a man and a woman in a car. The man is driving. The woman has a bag of groceries on her lap. And the man says, "Ugh, what smells like farts in here?" And the woman says, "That's the expensive French cheese we just bought." And the man says, "Oh, well, in that case, what smells so delicious in here?" So
okay,
it's the exact same odor. But you can perceive it very differently. So imagine getting a caress on the arm from your sweetheart in a very loving, connected time. It feels really good. And then imagine that same caress, exactly the same touching of your skin, the same pressure, the same speed, the same temperature, everything, but in the middle of an argument with your sweetheart where things are unresolved. It's not just that it feels the same, but you think about it differently. It actually feels different. And the reason is because the higher areas of the brain that are computing social context and expectation, areas with names like the parietotemporal junction and the orbitofrontal cortex, they send information to the part of your brain where you feel that touch and give it its emotional context and change that sensation. And so that is how context changes your perception.
I tried what you were talking about. It gets a quick rebuff.
It really does. So, you know, imagine an arm around your shoulder from a domineering boss, mm-hmm. versus your best buddy, versus someone hitting on you in a bar. It could be the exact same arm around the shoulder with the exact same stimulation on your skin, but each one of those things feels different in the very first moment you're consciously aware of the touch sensation. And that is because there is no sensation without personal history, without expectation, without cultural ideas.
What about how some people experience more pain than others from exactly the same stimulus? I mean, is that also the same thing, the emotional and discriminative systems in the brain that determine that?
Well, so that's a great question. We don't entirely know. So let me back off, and instead of saying two different people, let's talk about the same person at two different times.
Okay.
So a great example is from soldiers in combat. So in the Iraq War, there was a Army private named Dwayne Turner, and his unit came under attack. There was a grenade came over the wall where he and the fellow soldiers were sitting. He took massive blasts up and down his leg and his abdomen. He didn't even notice. He ran out to pull his injured comrades to safety. The Army believes that he saved 12 men from that day. He was awarded the Silver Star for valor. During that time, he was shot twice, once in the arm and once in the leg. He never even noticed. And at one point, someone who was uninjured said, "Hey, you've been hit." And he said, "No, that's another guy's blood. I just got it on me when I was dragging it in here." And they said, "No, you've been shot. You've been fragged. You're in trouble." And they had to hold him down to keep from going. So this is situational. 3 days later, he is in the field hospital, and they're drawing blood from his arm. and they bungle it and do a bad job. And he complains about the inept blood draw just like anyone else would. So the situation is that it doesn't diminish his heroism to say he's not superhuman. It's just that in that situation, the context can modify how we feel. Now, the question that you asked about different people and their pain thresholds is also interesting. And we actually know very, very little about that. There are a few very rare, like one in many millions of people who are born with no pain sensation at all. And then it's very likely that there is genetic variation that underlies diminished or enhanced pain sensation. But actually that there's very little evidence for it at this point.
You know, just to follow up on this, I'm thinking about people who dissociate and don't, like they've had some traumatic experience and then they dissociate from what they're feeling and they don't feel anything. But they're not born that way. It's not the disease you're talking about where a person can't feel pain, but it's a psychological function. Do you know about that?
Yes. So the good news is that the modification of the unpleasantness of pain by your mental state can be used for both good or ill. So if you have chronic pain, you tend to worry a lot. When is the pain going to end? When is it going to come back? And that anxiety actually makes the chronic pain worse, which makes the anxiety worse, and you have a terrible positive feedback loop. But you can break that feedback loop through practices that reduce anxiety and through practices through which you learn to accept your pain and realize that it's not going to kill you. And these include practices like open presence meditation, which is very effective for chronic pain relief.
What is the name of that?
In the case of open presence meditation.
Okay.
I think the thing to realize when we speak about meditation, a lot of people say, oh, meditation does this, meditation does that. There are so many different forms of meditation that are so different from each other that using the word meditation is about as precise as using the word sports without specifying whether it's baseball or hockey.
Interesting. We're speaking with Dr. David J. Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's the author of The Compass of Pleasure and The Accidental Mind. And in this case, we're discussing his latest book, which is Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. On Topical Currents, we'll be right back. Short break.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with David Linden. He's a neuroscience professor at Johns Hopkins. His book is Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And he's joining us from Baltimore. David, the question that Bonnie has been kind of driving me crazy with the last couple of days is, why can't we tickle ourselves?
Oh, I love that question. So the reason we can't tickle ourselves is because there is a circuit in our brain that causes us to turn down the sensation on things that result from our own motion. So let me give you an example. When you walk down the street and your clothes are moving against your body as a result of swinging your arms and legs, you don't attend very much to those sensations. But if you were standing still and your clothes moved against your body in that way, you would say, oh, who's groping me? What's going on? Those sensations would be very strong in your perception. The same thing happens when you go to tickle yourself. When you go to tickle yourself, the part of your brain that commands the muscles in your hand and arm to do the tickling motion sends signals to a part of the brain called the cerebellum. And from there, inhibitory signals are sent to the part of the brain where the tickling sensation is felt, and they damp them down. So you can't tickle yourself unless you have damage to your cerebellum, in which case then you can.
Is that why it feels better to when someone else scratches your back?
It is part of the reason why it feels better when someone else scratches your back. What's the question that is certainly in probably in your minds, but maybe you don't want to say on the radio, but I'll say it anyway, is, well, why can we masturbate? Right?
Okay.
There's a form of self-stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
We can overcome it. But it's very popular to use pornography to overcome that stimulation. The reason why 50% of all the traffic on the internet is porn is from the same reason why you can't tickle yourself. It's because your brain is turning down the sensation that results from your own motions. And when people use porn, they are activating their brain in a way that counteracts that.
Why is massage, if my hand is hurting me and I'm massaging it in exactly the same way that somebody else would massage it, why does it feel so much better and more therapeutic when somebody else is doing it? And why, from an evolutionary standpoint, would that be true?
Well, we evolved in social groups. Humans and pre-human hominins have been in social groups for a very, very long time. And so we're very attuned to social interaction, not just in touch, but in knowing where someone's gaze is, from shadings of vocal tone, from facial expressions, all these things we're extraordinarily good at decoding. And it turns out that in the case of the hairy skin, which is the skin over almost all your body except for the palms of your hands and the soles of your feet and your lips and a few other places, you have special caress detectors. They are there for interpersonal touch. And if you looked with a microscope, you would see that these nerve endings wrap around the base of hair follicles and they detect hair deflection. And not only that, but you know that if someone caresses your arm, if they do it at a real slow crawling speed, it doesn't feel good. And if they skim their fingers over really fast, it doesn't feel good. There's an intermediate speed of about 2 inches per second that feels really good to almost everyone. The same way with pressure. A really light touch is annoying. A real heavy touch doesn't feel loving. There's an intermediate level of touch. And these caress sensors, which are called C-tactile fibers, are tuned to be most strongly activated by precisely those interpersonal touches that we find to be most pleasant.
Do animals have the same systems in their brains for touch, other animals?
They have many of the very same systems in their brain. So, for example, we know that macaque monkeys have all the same heat, cold, pain, itch, mechanical sensation, and caress fibers that we do. They have a little bit of a different structure because they're much hairier than we are. And so the innervation of those hairs is a little different, but it's a fairly subtle difference. Basically, their touch sensation is like our touch sensation.
You have an area of the book where you talk about a mole that is particularly sensitive, much more than a human.
Well, so there's this animal called a star-nosed mole, and it lives in burrows, and it eats mostly worms, and it's a very cool looking. I mean, I love it. Other people think it looks like H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu. It has these tentacles that spray out from the front of its face. I think it's adorable. These tentacles are incredibly enriched in fine touch receptors, and as a mole moves through its dark burrows hunting for food, for worms or insects, each one of these tentacles probes independently, and then when a tentacle contacts something that it recognizes a food item, within a few thousandths of a second, the mole can lunge to consume it. There are other animals that have incredible adaptations. For example, rattlesnakes can strike accurately at prey a meter away in total darkness because they have infrared detectors and tiny pits in their face that allow them to do something like a thermal imaging scope that the military would have.
That's incredible. If animals are not touched when they're young, for one reason or another, their mother's taken away, whatever the case, are there ill effects as well in animals as there are in human beings?
Well, we don't know about all animals, and different animals have different ways of living. But if we look at our our mammalian cousins, then it seems like they are like us. So we know, for example, that if rat pups do not receive a lot of grooming and licking from their mothers when they are young, that when they grow up, they will be less exploratory of the environment, less willing to try new foods, have higher stress hormone levels, and have generally shorter lifespans. And you might think, well, if that's the case, why wouldn't all rat mothers just pay lots of attention to their children? But it's the work-life balance problem. If you're a wild rat and you happen to live in a place where there's tons of food nearby and you don't have to forage very much to feed yourself and your kids, well, then you've got lots of time to lick and groom your pups. Mm. But if you happen to live in a place that's food impoverished, well, then you have no choice but to go out hunting food lots of the time and leave those pups back in the nest.
Well, let's touch our listeners. Do you have a question about touch, any aspect of it? Are you a toucher or a touchy, or do you shun being touched or touching others? Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org.
Doctor, how about, or David, excuse me, you wanted to be called David, how about touch etiquette? Say we're standing in a crowded elevator and somehow my front is on someone's back, but it's okay because somehow I'm communicating to them that I'm not I'm not making any passes or anything.
Well, again, it's all about context, and it's also all about cultural ideas, right? So there are some social and religious groups who have very strong prohibitions against interpersonal touch, particularly between the sexes, and segregate people as a result. In the 1960s, there was an anthropologist named Sidney Girard, and he famously spied on people in cafes, and he went to Puerto Rico, to San Juan, and he saw that people there, not just lovers, but friends or business associates, would touch each other about 180 times an hour on average. And then he went to New York City and saw it was about 30 times an hour, and Paris was about the same, and then he got to London and it was zero times an hour. And so this just points out the idea that it's not that there is one optimal way to touch, that the way touch feels to us is molded by our own experience, and that includes our culture and our religion, and that these things are thought about very differently in different cultural contexts.
Where does the American culture fit in the scheme of the whole world, touch-wise?
Well, you know, the thing is, there is no one American culture.
That's true.
Right? Okay. You're in a melting pot. I'm in a melting pot, too. Mm-hmm. I could go to communities within Baltimore and find places where people were touching probably as much as they do in San Juan. And I could go find some other communities where people probably were touching about as much as they do in London. I would say the touch culture in the United States has probably gotten more pro-touch over the years as a result of immigration. And I think that's a good thing, because if there's one thing we know about appropriate social touch that is wanted, is that it fosters emotions of trust and cooperation. It's the social glue that binds sexual partners into lasting couples, that binds families together, and that promotes trust and cooperation in the workplace and in the community as well.
Briefly tell us about the study of basketball players. It always seems so monotonous when a guy misses a free throw and they high-five everybody. Then he makes a free throw and they high-five everybody. It's like, oh, come on, you don't need to do that. But it's been proven that teams are more successful to do that.
Yes, it turns out there was a study done by Dr. Keltner and his group at UC Berkeley where it's kind of a fun study. They sat down with beer and chips and they scored a whole bunch of early season NBA games in one season for all the teams in the NBA. And they scored all the chest bumps and high fives and butt slaps and things that people do to celebrate, fist bumps, what have you. And then they asked the question, does touch behavior early in the season predict how the team does later in the season? And the answer is that teams that touch more early in the season, not only do they win more games, but they play in a more cooperative fashion. The stars are less likely to hog the ball, for example.
Well, I want to talk more about another study you did, that one out of Yale, but we need to take a short break on today's topical currents. We're speaking with Dr. David J. Linden, the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We'll be right back.
Now, was Jim Morrison wanting just you to touch your heart, but not physically?
Oh, from Jim Morrison, I would not think so. Okay. Well, of course, that's The Doors. It's Topical Currents. Touch Me, the name of the song, Jim Morrison. Speaking with Dr. David J. Linden on today's Topical Currents. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And his latest book is Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind.
David, a lot of the research on touch is also going on at the University of Miami with Tiffany Field. Briefly touch on what they're doing.
So Dr. Field is a world expert on the beneficial effects of touch that can be brought in clinical practice, in particular massage therapy. And she's done a lot of work that has conclusively established that massage therapy is beneficial for chronic pain, particularly chronic joint pain. And she has been one of a number of people around the world who has shown that massage is key for promoting development in preterm infants. So she is an absolute world leader in this area. You're very happy. You're very lucky to have her in South Florida.
Okay, let's move on to Yale. Touch affecting our first impressions of people. Tell us about that study.
Well, this, to my mind, is something that's really surprising and remarkable. And it's that even incidental touch can change our first impressions. So when we first meet someone or hear about them, we very rapidly, with very few cues, form an impression of their character. And in this particular study, people were asked to hold either a warm drink or a cold drink before they read a resume of a potential job candidate, and then were asked a number of questions about to rate their impressions of the person depicted in that resume. And what they found was that people were holding hot drinks that the candidate was rated as more trustworthy and kind and a better team player. That is to say, they were rated literally as warmer. And when they did another study, they had the resume on light clipboards versus a very heavy clipboard about the weight of an old school laptop. And they found in that case that when people were holding the resume on a heavy clipboard, that they rated the person literally as having more gravitas, as being more serious and dedicated. Now, the interesting thing is that both in this case and in the warm cup case, it wasn't as if this conferred a general positive rating. In other words, people weren't rated as smarter, for example, or more insightful. They were just rated as warmer from the warm cup and weightier from the heavy clipboard.
So we don't have to make sure we have coffee at our next job interview. It won't necessarily make us get the job.
It wouldn't, it might make the person feel like, you were warmer, but that isn't necessarily, that's not the sole quality that people are usually evaluating for a job. Maybe if you are applying for a job to be a restaurant hostess, that would be a good thing to do because
yeah, right.
That's the main criterion they're looking for in that job, but maybe not for, say, an air traffic controller.
Let's take some calls. We've got Joe in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Doctor, I've got something that I can honestly say that I love, and I don't know if you've ever heard of this. my wife or with her nails scratch my arms or rake my arms, I get goosebumps all over my body. I love it. And my younger son does the same thing, but it doesn't work on my wife. It doesn't work on my other son. And my wife says, well, there's something wrong with you, but I enjoy immensely the feeling. What is this about?
Okay.
Well, so that's a great question. The shorter answer is we don't know. In other words, it might be something having to do with genetic variation in the touch receptors in your skin. Pardon me. Or it might have to do with slightly different variations in wiring in your brain. Or it might be something that's heritable, or it might be something just from common experience. We know extraordinarily little about the subtle variations in touch sensation. In some other senses, we know more. So, for example, you know, some people like cilantro and some people don't. Well, we happen to know that one of the 400 odorant receptors in your nose has a genetic variant that if you have one particular flavor, you're not going to like cilantro, and the other if you have the other variant, then you're likely to like cilantro. And it may well be that there is a similar kind of explanation that will ultimately emerge for variation in touch receptors that would explain this listener's sensation. But at present, we don't have that level of explanation.
I find it interesting that there are many things, as we speak about them, that still puzzle you after all your research and all the science and writing this book. It seems like there's still a lot of questions.
Well, there are. I mean, there for every one study on touch, there are probably 200 studies on vision. So touch has been a somewhat under-researched area in the neurobiology world. And there are a lot of things we don't know. But there's been an enormous amount of progress in the last 10 or 15 years as well.
A couple of years ago, David, I had Aaron Bralston on. I'm sure you remember the hiker who had to saw off his arm because it was trapped
yes.
under a boulder. And on the program, he demonstrated his prosthesis. He was able to tell it to either crush a beer can. He could also pick up an egg without breaking it. How does our brain tell our hands just how much to tighten something that's delicate?
Yeah, what's interesting is that for people who don't have a prosthesis, it's not your brain at all. It's your spinal cord that's telling you. So when you go to pick up an egg, you don't have to think actively about how much pressure to use. It's an automatic thing that you do. And here's how it works. There are special detectors called Meissner endings in your skin, and they're there in your finger pads. And you pick up that egg with a small amount of force, and as you do, the egg slips just a tiny little bit, just a few thousandths of a millimeter along your skin. And that microscopic slip is picked up by these Meissner endings, and it sends electrical message to your spinal cord, and the spinal cord has a reflex that says, okay, contract the muscles just a little bit harder to grip it more, and you grip it a little more, and then it still slips, and then the reflex says grip it a little more, and you grip it a little more, and then it's fine, and then you found the optimal grip strength so that it's not going to slip out of your hand, but on the other hand, you're not going to crush it and get the egg all over the place. And it turns out that this reflex doesn't actually require the brain at all.
Are there other afflictions that make people sensory deprived? What I mean is there a person that wouldn't know how much pressure to actually exert to pick up that egg? The Meissner endings aren't functioning properly?
Yes, that's a great question. It turns out there's a very rare phenomenon called touch blindness, where people have lost essentially all of their mechanical touch sensation. They still have some pain sensors, for example. But they've lost not only the Meissners, but also the other sensors that do things like vibration or fine texture. And if someone has this disease, which is called primary sensory neuronopathy, then if you touch them on the leg, they'll have no idea that they were even touched there at all. They are touch blind. There's something else that can happen. So recall that I said that There are parts of the two parts of the brain, one for emotional touch and one for the discriminative factual aspects of touch. So if you have damage to the part of your brain that has emotional touch processing, then you have phenomena like pene symbolia. And what that means is I hit you on the thumb with a hammer, and instead of saying, "Ow, that's terrible, that hurts," the way someone would normally, you would say in a very flat voice, "Yes, it's painful. It's on my thumb. It's throbbing now." None of the normal emotional negative consequences of pain would be there. And it's not that these people are masochists. Masochists love pain. They have a very strong emotional response to pain that's just positive. These people are entirely indifferent to pain. The same thing can happen with orgasm. We think of orgasm as being intrinsically emotionally positive. But if you have damage to your brain's reward and emotional touch circuits, you can have an orgasm that is more like a sneeze than like what one would normally experience because it lacks that emotional component.
Speaking of orgasm, are our genitals more sensitive than other areas of our bodies? Do they have more receptors than anywhere else?
So that's a really good question. So we know that to do something that requires very fine tactile discrimination, like reading Braille, for example, we can use our fingertips, and our fingertips are very good at this. And you can also use your lips or your tongue. They're also very good at this. And there are some other areas of the body that we think of as being very sensitive, like the cornea of the eye or the genitals. And certainly in either of those places, if you take a little, say, little bit of grit and put it in your eye, you're going to feel it. And if you put it against your genitals, you're going to feel it. Very tiny skin deflections can be sensed. However, the cornea of the eye and the genitals lack a nerve ending called a Merkel ending, which is what you need for the fine discriminative sensation. So if you try to read Braille with your genitals or with your eyeball, it will actually fail. And if your listeners don't believe me, they can go down to the ATM, they can wait till no one's around, and they can try the experiment themselves. But don't call me for bail if you get arrested.
Yeah. We're speaking to Dr. David Linden from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His latest book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. One more short break.
And we return. It's 46 minutes past 1 o'clock. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and neuroscientist Dr. David Linden. We're talking about her book, his book. His book, Touch. And let's take another call. We've got Robert in Deerfield Beach. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Robert. I wanted to add something to the conversation, Dr. Linden, which I find incredibly fascinating. In the ISS, the International Space Station, we have humans who are in weightless space 6-8 months sometimes, and that might be another area to investigate. But I wanted to comment on touch's control in society. I find that when I'm in a network meeting, sometimes when I feel friendly to somebody, I'll touch their elbow or their hand, and that I found is just almost an instinct that I do. I also work with the elderly, and I realize that when I touch a shoulder, even if there's light clothing, they react positively. And how it happens to result in the autonomic nervous system and the spine, but there are so many avenues to your research that are phenomenal for all of us. And I thought of something funny. I said if somebody has a warm cup in their hand, you know, in a job interview, it might be just as well to have an interview on the beach, you know, where your whole body is warm and you're sure to get hired, you know. But I find it very interesting. The French have something called frottage, which is where they will rub up to someone else publicly, generally in a subway. And people are not adverse to that. It's sort of just like almost like a bump in an elevator.
Mm.
And
David?
At the same time, yeah, but it's, I don't think you can do that in a New York subway. It would be a different story.
Any comment there, David?
Well, I think the thing that I would like to extract from there is the issue about touching the elderly. So it turns out that there's kind of bad news, and that is starting at about age 20, we all lose about 1% of the nerve endings subserving touch in our skin every year. We don't notice it when we're young. We don't notice it when we're middle-aged. But by the time we're elderly, we've lost most of our pain sensors, of our fine touch sensors, of our sexual sensation sensors, of all the different touch sensors that there are. And this is compounded by folks who are in institutional settings where a lot of times there isn't very much loving touch for them to experience. It may be that their partner is gone or that their family isn't around very much. And in these settings, work by Tiffany Field and by a number of other people has shown that even stranger touch in the form of massage or even just a little bit of nice social touching from someone doing the hair or attending to someone's bodily needs can have an enormous benefit. It can reduce anxiety. It can reduce depression. It can maintain cognitive focus in folks who are struggling with dementia. There are all kinds of positives for maintaining touch as we age.
Aren't there consequences, though? Is that why the elderly fall so much? Is it something that they're missing, that they're not feeling certain things, and that's why they fall?
Well, there are lots of reasons why the pardon me. There are lots of reasons why the elderly fall so much.
Right.
One is muscle weakness. Another is balance problems. But a third is exactly what you're saying. So when you lose these nerve endings, one of the places you lose them is the soles of your feet. And then it is harder to sense the ground under your feet and adjust your stance properly. And this is a contributing factor, an important contributing factor, to devastating falls in the elderly.
I have another question. Can physical violence to someone else have an effect on us? I'm thinking about like a boxing match when someone's getting pummeled. Is that just our brains imagining that we're feeling pain, or do we actually feel pain?
Well, so the sort of social contagion of touch is something that varies a lot from person to person, with the exception of the sensation of itch. So almost anyone, if they see people around them scratching, will start to feel itchy and will scratch themselves. And there's an evolutionary reason for this, because the reason we have itch is mostly to remove insects and worms and other sources of infestation. And so it makes sense. If we see people around us being infested, we have to worry that we're infested ourselves. Some people feel when they see a blow landing on someone else's body, feel a sensation very strongly. Most people don't. It turns out that when you watch films of people caressing, you can see activation of the emotional touch area, the posterior insula, produced just by watching those films. I'm not now talking about sexual behavior, but just a caress on the arm.
Okay, so are you feeling, if you do have that, where you're feeling when someone else gets hit, are you feeling, are those people that have that, whatever that would be, exaggerated or magnified, are they feeling that pain?
Well, they are in a sense, yes. I mean, mostly what they are feeling, remember I said for pain and all the other sensations, there's sort of an emotional part, and
right.
Then there is a literal fact-based part. And if you had someone, when you have people who feel this in the brain scanner, what you find is that the emotional pain circuit is activated, but the facts of pain circuit is not.
How about becoming pruny in the bath if you soak too long?
Oh, well, so that's a real interesting thing. You know, most people, and I assumed also for many years, that the reason you get pruny in the bath, everyone knows that the outer layer of your skin is dead cells. And you think, well, those cells kind of absorb water and they swell up and there isn't enough room for that expanded skin, so it folds in on itself and that's what gets pruny. And that turns out to be wrong, because if you actually cut what's called the sympathetic motor nerve that innervates your hands, then, or if you take a corpse and dip the corpse's hand in the water, it won't get pruny. This is something I don't suggest that your listeners do at all. either of those things. I mean, I know it is South Florida, but still.
Yes.
Still, so it turns out that pruny hands come from messages from the brain that cause the skin to prune up. And then the question is, well, so what are they for? And there's some debate in scientific circles, but a lot of people believe that it is there so that you can get a better grip on things when things are wet. And so an analogy is car tires. You know, race cars that only drive on tracks that are completely dry and completely smooth use tires that are smooth. You actually get the best grip in those conditions with a tire that doesn't have ridges in it. However, cars that we drive out in the real world have to be driven in all kinds of different conditions, uneven roadways, grit, wet snow. And in that situation, it's actually you can get a better grip when you have little ridges to channel the water and the sand away. And so people believe that pruny fingers make it easier for you to grip things when they're wet.
David, Bonnie and I have gotten a little bit closer here in the studio, and we want to do the cutaneous rabbit illusion that you talk about. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, okay. Sure. I don't know if it's going to make very good radio.
Well, she's got her arm here, and what I'm going to do right is I tap her three times on the wrist, and then three times on the inside of her elbow. And she has to have her eyes closed, correct?
She does. And the other thing that is extremely tricky is that you shouldn't do it with the same hand because there's no way you'll be able to get over there fast enough. So you should tap three times on the wrist with one hand and then three times on the elbow with a different hand. And the trick is that the gap between taps number 3 and 4 has to be exactly the same as the very brief gaps between taps 1, 2, and 3, or the illusion won't work.
Okay, I got it.
Now I think.
Did it work? It worked.
Now it worked.
Because
we tried it earlier.
So she felt it move down her arm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, I think we need to describe for your listeners what exactly we're talking about, because I'm sure everyone is just utterly befuddled. So the cutaneous rabbit illusion is a tactile illusion. The same way that there are visual illusions, there are also tactile illusions. And if you tap three times on the wrist and then three times on the elbow, and you do it with these equal gaps in between it, what you actually feel is instead of 3 at the wrist and 3 at the elbow, you feel 1 at the wrist and then the next 2 hopping along your arm, and then the sensation actually hops from your wrist to your elbow. And the reason for this is because your brain is hardwired to think that things can only move so fast in the world from one place to another along your body. And so your brain is trying to make sense of stimuli that it is not expecting, and that's where this illusion comes from.
All right, we only have just a few seconds left, but we have an emailer that I think has an important question. Can the lack of touch as a toddler be reversed later in life, for example, with adopted children?
The answer is that if you've got a kid who hasn't received social touch at all by age 2, there's not that much you can do later in life, unfortunately. I mean, it's a good idea if you have that kid to give them lots of touch, because it's good ideas to give all kids that age lots of touch. But unfortunately, by that time, if someone has been severely touch-deprived, like a Romanian orphan from the 1990s, there will be lasting effects even if good touch begins later in life.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking with Dr. David J. Linden. He's professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Also the author of The Compass of Pleasure, The Accidental Mind. We've been discussing his latest book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. So happy to have you with us today and glad it all worked out, David.
Thanks for having me. Stay warm.
You too.